Board. Hey, everybody. This is Nan. Wait, no, wait. This is Melrose Sheltering in Place. I'm Nan.
You were still correct. You are Nan, and I'm Christopher.
I know. It's just not the usual order in which I always say the intro thing. And not that it really matters, but it felt weird.
It's good to mix things up once in a while. What can I say?
It felt like I was making a mistake.
We've definitely made a mistake by starting a podcast about Melrose Place. Just kidding. I love it. I love this. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm chilling, you know, whatever, doing the thing. I found out, so I've been taking classes at the community college to get my licensed chemical dependency counselor license. And I took classes in the summer session. And the sessions, like the semesters are weird. Like they're split up into kind of two sections. So there's like, so the summer section, there was like a first part that was like 4 weeks long and a second part that was 4 weeks long. So I took two classes and then two classes. And the fall, I thought, well, maybe that's just the summer. You know, summers are weird. Mm-hmm. But then the fall was the same way.
Huh.
So I have a class that was supposed to start this week and run through October. And then I had two more classes that start in October and run through December. Well, I got on yesterday to see if they had posted my room number yet for my class, and it disappeared. And I think what happened was, because the last time I looked at it on Friday to see if they had given me a room, there were only four people in the class. And it was like 25 seats. And I was like, ooh, that's weird. I bet that's not going to make. But it's weird that they haven't canceled it yet.
Yeah.
And then yesterday I get on there and it's gone. And the only evidence. And the thing is like, it's not like it's there and it just says canceled. And I haven't gotten any notifications. The only evidence it ever even existed is that on my balance for my tuition, it says they owe me $270.
Oh.
But other than that, there's literally no evidence that this even happened, that this class ever existed, nothing in the system. And so I'm going to call tomorrow and just be like, what happened? But if I'm completely honest, I'm like, oh, well, yeah. That just means I don't have to deal with having a class for the next, you know, like 2 months or whatever.
I went to go file my weekly unemployment claim this morning, and they turned on two-factor authorization on the site. So, you know, like you have to send you a code and then your computer gets recognized. But unfortunately, the emails with the code never came. And then they have the option to text it, but I can see the last four numbers of the phone number and it's wrong. Like my two of the numbers are switched around, so I can't try that. And then they're like, and if you have any problems, call us. But, you know, it's the Washington unemployment, so the wait times are excessive. So, like, if I call them tomorrow, I fully assume I will be on hold for, like, 90 minutes. Not looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's a bummer. My dog is over here trying to bury the cord for my microphone under the covers.
Uh-oh.
She's like, she's got burying instinct and she just does it compulsively. If I put anything on the bed next to me, like my phone, she will just try to compulsively bury it.
Huh.
It's crazy.
I'm trying to think of a practical application for that. Like,
I mean, I think some of it is related to nest making, which she also does compulsively. She's doing it right now, actually. She's buried the thing. Now she's making her nest. But I think it's also like, I think they like bury their food or something.
Oh, when I said that, I meant like a way that you could take advantage of it, like put her to work.
Oh, yeah. God. Oh, this dog is worthless. Hmm. She's too special to be put to work. She's just going to. Gonna keep. Sometimes she tries to bury me. Like I'll be sitting on the couch, and if the blanket is right next to my butt, I'll feel this like flicking, and it'll be. She's like trying to get the cover over my butt, and it's funny.
I did one of our very favorite things ever yesterday.
You went to the spa.
I did, and I even got the scrub and massage because I've been going to the spa a lot because they had a sale while I still had a job for discounted passes, and I bought a bunch, which has been great because now that I don't have a job, I'm going on prepaid passes. So it's like, you know, something you can feel good about doing when you're trying to be on a budget. But I splurged yesterday and I got our favorite scrub and massage to celebrate and recover from finishing the last section of a 30-mile trail that I've been working on. Which when you're by yourself, you have to actually go 60 miles to do that because you have to get back to your car each time.
Oh, right. Oh my gosh.
And so yesterday I finished the last 4.4 miles. So I walked 8.8 and that was on top of the 6 the day before. And so I was like, you know what? I could use some manhandling on these calves specifically.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh my gosh.
Unfortunately, I've learned that I can no longer, you know, when you're face down and they're working on your back, he puts a little towel under my forehead and he has me have my head sideways. And I've learned I can't do that anymore because now I can barely turn my head the other direction and it's all stiff. So I think from now on, I'm going to have to ask for like extra towel so I can stay face down or something. Because turning my head for too long is something I've lost the ability to do because I'm old.
Yeah. Womp womp. Yeah. It's kind of amazing, like, the little ways in which, yeah, my body is just, oh, that hurts now sometimes. That's wild, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, the back of my left knee is, like, super mad about all the walking. Like, it doesn't hurt, but it's very tight. And so I know, like, if I don't get to work with some of those good old PT exercises over the next couple of days, it's probably going to have, like, a cascading effect. So I've been diligent with those lately, though, which is a good thing. Because I've also learned I'm going to be doing it forever.
Well, should we get into the episode?
Yeah, the terribly named episode 21 from season 3, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Dinner at 8. Kimberly is annoyed because Michael is heading to New York with Amanda to convince Dr. Steele to take her on as a patient. And over at Melrose Place, Amanda tells Allison and Billy that they'll be in charge over at D&D while she's gone. And Amanda is also convinced she's going to die. She specifically said that she has a snowball's chance in hell. Billy and Allison meet with an angry client who wants a new campaign quickly. And he also wants to know where Amanda is. Excuse me. They explain that they're in charge while she's in New York, but they can authorize a new campaign. So he says he'll see them tomorrow morning with a new presentation, which means they have to stay up all night working on it. Amanda and Michael check into their hotel after their flight was delayed for 3 hours, and they learn that they're sharing a room and that there are no more rooms left. Michael promises to behave, and we learn after Amanda walks away that Michael specifically reserved just one room. He engineered this awkward situation. Kimberly calls later and is furious when she asks for Michael's room and Amanda answers the phone. The next morning, Sydney gets a hold of Dr. Steele while Michael... That's not Sydney, that's... How do I do that again? That's Kimberly. Kimberly.
Okay, well, while you're updating it, yeah. I just want to say that, like, okay, so I get that humans are just, like, sort of can be very just petty in general. So, it like, but it continues to amaze me that suddenly we have gone from Kimberly was trying to kill Michael in revenge for him, like, doing what he did, to suddenly now she's, like, super possessive of him.
Right.
And... like, it's just, it's so funny. It's like, it's just the show continues to just be like, listen, you just have to follow this.
Yeah.
Where it's going. And it's not necessarily going to make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, we've got this little cast and we just have to work them through all the cycles because we need content. Because we're doing 33 or so episodes a season and they're an hour. And we only have like a week to write each one. The next morning Kimberly calls New York and gets a hold of Dr. Steele while Michael and Amanda are waiting in the lobby, and she makes up a story about Michael being there because he wants to discredit his research and run a similar study in LA. So he has his assistant tell Michael and Amanda that he's taking an early retirement. Michael tries to intimidate the assistant, but she says that in New York, they eat Angelino worms like him for breakfast. Michael and Amanda head to Tiffany's to buy expensive jewelry while standing under a boom microphone.
I keep not seeing them. I need to pay more attention.
Should I just text you the pictures as they happen?
Yeah, if you could do that, that would be amazing. Because yeah. I'm just not seeing it, and I don't want to spend all my time watching Melrose Place like looking for the boom.
Yeah,
mic, but I want to see. I want to see this phenomenon.
Yeah, it's like You don't want to distract yourself from the experience of the show, but if I have that kind of peripheral boom seeking vision, then I can totally take that on. Allison and Billy pitch their new campaign to the client, who is a cruise line owner, and he hates it because they've described the first class experience, which is only 10% of the business. He pulls the account from D&D. Amanda,
dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, they lost the big account on their first day in charge. Amanda and Michael dance at a fancy restaurant, but she's feeling hopeless. When she asks why she should fight, he kisses her.
This is like this. I just can't. Okay, you and I were texting about this, yeah. And you said you were 400% here for it. I can't. I just can't get into this whole Michael and Amanda pairing. I mean, if they were like getting together to like plot against somebody and also fuck, then I could get into that.
Yeah.
But this whole like you're dying, I love you situation that's about to unfold. I mean, Michael's going to make it scuzzy, of course.
Yeah.
He always does. That's going to come up later. But like, I don't know. Just like, what? And it's kind of like earlier, like when he was telling Kimberly in the like last episode or so, she's my friend. I have to do this for my friend. Like, blah, blah, my friend. And I'm like, who has friends on this show? Like, who, what are y'all talking about?
Well, like, and it's weird because there are people who are friends on this show and you wonder why. Like, Michael and Billy are friends. Why?
Yeah.
Why are
they? Yeah. Why?
Like, Matt will confide in Michael. Why? I don't know. So Amanda calls Allison and Billy the next morning, and they decide not to tell Amanda that they lost the client, and they tell her to stay in New York as long as she needs. Under another boom microphone, Allison says that they should tell the client that Amanda is sick so that they can play on his sympathies. But Billy won't participate and says not to come crying to him if it backfires. Michael bursts into Dr. Steele's office to make his case for Amanda. Steele reveals that he got a call about Michael and then did his own research and would never trust Michael enough to work with him. And I'm so curious what that research could be because there's no internet yet. Anyway, Michael says he'll turn Amanda's case over to somebody else if Steele agrees to help. So he does. Allison meets with that cruise client to try to convince, to try to rescue the account and reveals that Amanda has cancer. He says he'll take it under advisement and thanks her for being so candid. She returns to D&D beaming, but a letter from a courier arrives quite quickly, almost too quickly, one might say, to let her know that D&D has been officially dumped. At dinner in New York, Amanda gets an emergency phone call that's supposedly from Jake, but it's really Kimberly on the line to tell her Michael's playing her, and Dr. Steele's protocol can't help her and that she's terminal. Amanda rushes out of the restaurant. Michael spends all night in the hotel room under a boom microphone trying to track Amanda down, who comes back in the morning. That was three boom mics so far in this episode, by the way. With downtown Los Angeles clearly visible out the window of their New York hotel room, like you can see very recognizable LA buildings like the Bonaventure Hotel.
This is extremely on brand,
yeah,
for Mellor's Place.
Like they could have closed the curtains.
Right? Oh my God.
Why even bother getting a hotel room as a set when you could just use a set and have it be better? Michael tries to convince Amanda that he cares about her, and he admits that he withdrew from the study so Steele would take her on. At Steele's office, Amanda asks him to let Michael stay involved, and he agrees. That was easy. Michael buys Amanda flowers to apologize for going behind her back with Steele and for kissing her, but she asks him to do it again. Matt helps Joe clean up her trashed apartment, and he tries to reassure her that everything will be okay. As a reminder, it's trashed because the corrupt gay cop was there looking for the photos she took of him beating up a suspect. And that suspect died. He says they haven't done anything wrong, which is odd because he is hiding pictures that would implicate gay cop John Hollings in the beating. Oh, and I revealed that he died too soon. At this point, that suspect is just in a coma. Spoilers.
Spoiler alert. Plot twist.
Jane wakes up to find Sydney has made a huge breakfast and wants to be Jane's personal assistant to make up for all the trouble with Martin's cult. But Jane's not interested at all. Gay cop John comes to Matt's office and says there's a homophobic cop on the force trying to set him up. And he needs to know if Joe took any pictures, because if so, they could be used against him. Jane goes to Shooters to ask Jake to give Sydney her job back, since it was actually Ricky who trashed the place. He agrees, and he visits Sydney to make the offer, and he awkwardly leaves once she accepts, which makes it really obvious that it was not his idea. Joe goes to Matt's in a panic because now Jake, gay cop John's beating victim, dies. He says he'll hand the photos over for Joe as though that will somehow keep her safe when she's obviously the one who took them. He heads to the police station with the photos and meets Bob Wilkins from Internal Affairs. He gives him the photos along with the negatives, and he asks that he and his anonymous friend be left alone. But Bob remembers him and Joe and knows Joe was there that night and is a photographer, but he agrees to minimize Joe's involvement. Gay cop John spots him on the way out and is furious. Sydney comes to Shooters for her shift and tells Jake that she's missed him and wants to be close again. So Jake reveals that he rehired her as a favor to Jane. Later, Jane stops by Shooters to meet up with Jake, leaving Sydney furious. Joe and Matt are interrupted at dinner by gay cop Rawlings, who kicks his way in and pulls a gun. Matt says he'll tell the police that he was there and he saw something that would exonerate him. And when Rawlings breaks down, Joe grabs the gun, because Joe always grabs every gun in sight.
Joe loves guns.
Yeah,
let's talk about it.
She, when she's not getting shot by them, she's grabbing them and hiding them in her purse and all kinds of stuff. Guns, guns, guns. And that was the episode.
Man, yeah. So many things happening.
A lot.
In that episode. But I don't know that there's anything to say about a lot of them except for, like, Michael and Amanda. Ew. Gross. Grossing me out.
See, I'm intrigued. Especially because of the way that, like, you know, he's kind of, at least if he's to be believed, like, these are things that he's never truly felt before, you know?
I mean, but do we feel like that can be true about Michael Mancini? I just, when he says I love you, I'm like, bro, can you love somebody? I'm not 100% sure I buy it. Like,
what I'd like to see is, I'd like for her to, like, dominate him.
Oh, yeah, that would be fun.
Like, I would like to see him on his hands and knees in nothing but like boxers and sock garters and maybe a ball gag. And like, you know, she's eating her dinner on a plate that's on his back like he's a table.
Yeah. Now you're talking. Yeah. That's a totally different kind of TV show.
True. That's the Showtime version of Melrose Place.
The Skinamax. All right. Well, now we have episode 22, The Winner and the Winner Is. Kimberly confronts Michael when he leaves at the hospital. Kimberly confronts Michael when he arrives at the hospital and accuses him of sleeping with Amanda in New York. She calls Amanda to tell her to step off and to dial 1-800-GET-YOUR-OWN-MAN if she needs one. At the hospital, Amanda makes business cards while doing her chemo until Michael comes in and takes the phone away. Business calls. I don't know why I said cards. The other doctor says the stress from her job is interfering with her treatment and that she needs to take some time off work. Michael made reservations at a resort in Santa Barbara, but she's got the Century Awards that weekend. Michael lies to Kimberly and says he's heading to Santa Barbara for work and that he'll be working weekends for the time being to earn extra cash so they can go to Maui. She falls for it. But she definitely, I felt like she sensed that something might be up, right? Like the fix was in. I don't know. Amanda returns to D&D and Allison and Billy tell her they saved the Franklin Cruz account, which is the first time Amanda's heard there was a problem. They explain the account was only in danger because she left it with a subpar concept and that Allison managed to save it. And Amanda points out that other accounts were neglected in the process and that the quarterly reports need to be finished. Plus, Allison forgot to enter Amanda into the Century Awards. Amanda tells Allison to take the form to their offices in Long Beach herself and let it slip that she's ill.
Did I miss something about the account being saved? Because they got a letter from a courier saying that it wasn't, right?
I thought the letter happened later.
It was
in the story.
It was. I had it in the last episode's notes, so I don't know. I guess maybe more will be revealed.
I don't know. Maybe there was another account. I have no idea. Like, I don't know. It kind of doesn't even matter. It's kind of funny because we're both just like, wait, did that happen? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like, does it even matter if they get their facts straight in this show? We're just going to keep on watching it like a couple of dingleberries.
Well, and it's funny because after forgetting to watch a third episode for our last episode, when we were done recording last week, I immediately watched all three. That's like, accountability.
Allison arrives at the Century Awards offices to hand off Amanda's entry form to Brooke Armstrong, who notices that they aren't entering the Glorious Gowns campaign, which Allison worked on. She convinces Allison to enter the contest and asks if they can go to lunch sometime because she wants to get back into an agency. And this is when Kristen Davis from Sex and the City shows up.
Yeah, and this has to be how she ended up on Sex and the City, because this is her first exposure to Darren Star, presumably.
Oh, yeah, Darren Star, the Darren Star connection. That makes so much sense. Amanda calls Billy and Allison into her office to let them know she'll be out the next day and that she'll probably work from home the next week. She asks them to finish up the quarterly reports early so she can receive them via fax at the resort and tells them that they need to be a better team at work than they were a couple.
Ow.
They put in a long evening of work at home over Chinese food and feed each other bites of their food and then kiss.
No.
At work the next morning, Allison says they shouldn't have kissed, but he interrupts her with another kiss.
No.
Yeah, I think we knew this was going to happen, though. This is pretty obvious that this is the direction that we were going in. Michael and Amanda arrive at the resort, and he tells... Hold on. Okay. Michael and Amanda arrive at the resort and he tells Amanda he and Kimberly want different things And he's just going through the motions at this point. He kisses Amanda, and she reminds him that they aren't there to bone at lunch.
I just want, this made me think of something. Why does Michael get married so much? Like, he doesn't seem to want to be married, but he just keeps doing it.
Well, you know, like, this is kind of a man thing, I think, to some degree. Like, men don't do well when they're not married because they can't handle life
right well. Yeah,
and so, like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
that, I feel like it's like, yeah,
he can't even do laundry. He had to get Sydney to do that.
And it's like, I don't know that I get the sense that these women are necessarily doing too many chores. It's just like, just being alone, men cannot handle it. They're just not good at it. Anyway, burn. Straight men. Anyway, I don't know. Okay, so at lunch, Brooke tells Amanda how she ended up losing her previous advertising job. Similarly to Allison, an older woman at her agency also had it in for her. Allison asks if she's interested in an internship at D&D. Matt and Kimberly trade barbs at the hospital, and Matt tells her there hasn't been a program with Santa Barbara General for over a year, so Michael's not there. Dun, dun, dun. Joe and Allison review slides, and of course, Allison tells Joe that Amanda has cancer. Kimberly calls, pretending to be British, so she can get the number where Amanda and Michael are staying. Later on, Michael and Amanda enjoy a hot tub. Oh my God. This was my favorite moment.
Yeah.
This was my favorite moment of all three episodes.
Yeah.
This was so good. Okay, so scene. Amanda and Michael are in the hot tub and are bonding over how alike they are when suddenly Kimberly appears holding one of those standy lamps. Like those, like, we all had in the, you know, 90s.
The halogen torchiere lamp, yeah.
Yeah, like every dorm room ever. Like that was the lamp, right?
Yeah.
That I had in my, anyway. And standing, holding the standy lamp and threatening to throw it in the water. And just looking completely psychotic. And Amanda is completely unimpressed, saying she has no tolerance for liars. Amanda packs up and leaves. I love how, like, Michael acted freaked out, but Amanda was just like, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, rolled her eyes and, like, got out of the water.
I'm trying to enjoy the hot tub.
That scene was so freaking good.
Do you think it's because Amanda thinks she's dying anyway?
I mean, I think there's that, but also that's kind of always been her whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, she just is not going to let people intimidate her, ever. Even when they totally could throw that sandy lamp in the hot tub that you're in and, like, fry your ass. The next morning, Amanda confronts Allison for giving the hotel info to Kimberly and to make sure her entry into the Century Awards was taken care of. Allison says the entry was submitted, but of course doesn't mention that she entered as well. Michael comes home to find Kimberly in bed and tells her he stayed the night alone at the resort to give them some time to cool off. He makes up a story about Amanda becoming transfixed with him because she's worried about death, and he feared rejecting her would jeopardize the treatment. He'll break it off that night. She says she knows everything about him and accepts him for who he is and begs him not to leave her. If she accepts him for who she is, for who he is, then she's got to know he's full of shit.
Yeah.
This whole, like, Amanda's so obsessed with me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, let's face it. Michael and Kimberly are a match made in heaven. Allison stops by Amanda's before the awards, and Michael calls to let Amanda know he's on his way and that he's breaking up with Kimberly to be with her. Kimberly overhears him saying he'll be there in the limo in 15 minutes and says this better be the last time Michael and Amanda hang out. Also, like, Michael's just like, I promised her I would go and I have to go. Like, bro, if I was in the marital difficulties that they're having, like, no, absolutely not. You're not going.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand how Kimberly just stood there and was like, okay, this one last time.
Yeah, he should know that, like, if he goes, then there's a good chance that the next time he falls asleep, his throat's getting cut. Like,
right? Yes. Like, some revenge is going to be had.
Yeah.
Chuck Woolery hosts the Century Awards and announces the nominees, including Amanda and Allison. And Allison wins. Brooke takes Allison's seat when she heads up to accept and throws her arm on Billy, even though they've probably never met. Amanda walks out and Michael tells her he loves her in the hallway and that she won't lose him. oops, I hit
that. And, you know, I guess I should have given a little more verbiage to the absolute fury from Amanda when Allison won over her.
She got up and like walked out while Allison was giving her acceptance speech, and Allison was like, "And to Amanda Woodward, the best in the business." Amanda's definitely seeing the writing on the wall, mm-hmm. that you know, like, if she's taking time off for her cancer treatment, she's gonna get overtaken by her supposed, you know, protege or whatever.
Yeah.
At Shooters, Jake admits to Sydney that he and Jane are dating now. Yeah. Sydney warns her.
Gross.
Yeah, these episodes have some of the worst pairings ever.
It feels like a fantasy episode. Like, you know, like on Friends when there's like Fat Monica and whatever. It feels like one of those weird episodes that pops up about once every two seasons on a lot of shows where things are just different.
Yeah. I honestly just feel like it's just laziness. Like, they had to put some people together and it had to be like these people, you know, because like, whatever. Sydney warns her that she's shallow and that's why she's in a superficial business like fashion, and not to be surprised if Jane tries to fix his appearance. Like, they arrive home.
I did want to say, I do think Jake deserves a little nookie for driving to Tucson twice just because Jane didn't realize until they were literally in the courtyard at Melrose Place, wait a minute,
something is weird.
Yeah, like on the 10-hour drive she didn't have any time to think of that.
Yeah,
anyway,
that will forever just be the stupidest thing that ever happened. Sydney watches through her blinds as they kiss, then comes down and tells Jane she has a problem with them dating. Sydney says Jake's the love of her life, and when Jane blows her off, says all's fair in love and war. Ooh. And it'll definitely be war.
And, you know, maybe when people rescue you from a cult, you could, like, chill for a while and not do this kind of shit, right? Like,
so, yeah.
The two of them are the only reason that she's not living in a box underground in the desert.
They drove to Tucson and back twice for you.
Like, let them date. It's not going to last long anyway.
Yeah, for real. Jane and Jake enjoy dinner at a candle table at her place, and are interrupted by Sydney on the phone machine when they're trying to bone. She has car trouble and is calling from the Palomino, which worries Jake, so he picks up and says he's on his way. An MC announces that it's time for Palomino's famous black bra contest, and the guy Sydney's hanging out with tell her she should compete. She says no, and they rip her shirt off and carry her up on stage as Jake walks in to rescue her. With no discussion about where her car is, they get on Jake's bike to leave. But Cal, the leader of the guys Sydney's talking to, blocks them. He and Jake exchange punches, and of course, Jake wins.
Jake never loses a fight.
Jane comes to Jake's to ask what happened with Sydney. Jane isn't convinced Jake still doesn't have feelings for Sydney and breaks up with him. Also, my God, those pants that she was wearing.
Oh, I missed them.
Oh, my God. They were like jeggings.
Oh.
Like, they were like skin tight jeans, but like almost to the point where you're like, are those like fake jeans made to look like jeans but actually just leggings, or are they like really tight jeans? And also, she's got like the skinniest legs. Like, yeah, anyway, all I could look at was those fucking pants. Sydney comes to Jake's with steaks and beers, and he shows her the door but keeps the groceries. Sydney lies and says they're spending the evening together, but Jane says she's broken it off. And that is the episode.
Yeah. So that brings us to episode 23, Love and Death 101.
Which is the name of a Woody Allen movie.
Really?
Not the 101 part, but Love and Death.
Okay.
Is a movie made in the 70s. It's like a spoof on Russian, you know, like Anna Karenina type novels with Diane Keaton, and Woody Allen, of course, is in it as well.
Okay. Is it worth watching?
I enjoyed it. Of course, you know, things have changed since I watched it. I probably watched it like 15 years ago. Mm. And, you know, Woody Allen, anyway, feelings about that person. Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah. okay. Allison arrives at D&D with her award and learns that the board of directors is waiting in Amanda's office to talk to her, and Amanda is not there with them. The board and the clients want Allison to take over as president of D&D, which I'm sorry, but no, this would not happen. Allison's like 24 years old. She's been working there for 2 years. She was the receptionist like a year and a half ago. Sorry.
Yeah.
No. Amanda arrives later and is furious because she thinks Allison's out to lunch, but it turns out she's in her office, which is now her office. Since Brooke's there packing up Amanda's stuff, she's already in Amanda's crosshairs. Michael meets with a lawyer about a lawsuit against the city. Since nobody knows that he was drunk driving during his and Kimberly's accident, they're alleging poor road conditions. He wants $1 million, but the lawyer thinks that he can get $200,000. He heads to the hospital and tells Kimberly he previously sent their resumes to the Mayo Clinic and that they've been accepted. He says they want to see them tomorrow, but he can't make it, so he's sending her ahead without him.
I mean, this story that he's concocted, I can't believe that Kimberly went along with it.
Well, you know, she's wanted to leave LA for a long time.
I know, but I can't believe she believed him. Maybe he did really do it, because I guess she did go.
Yeah, like she does have interviews when she gets there. So he was smart enough to
actually do it.
Yeah.
It's
not like just she gets there and then she shows up at the Mayo Clinic and they're like, who the fuck are you? Which would be funny, but. And I just looked it up again. The Mayo Clinic is in Rochester, Minnesota. Amanda arrives home and calls Michael at the hospital because she's feeling worse and she got fired on top of that. Michael previously mentioned somewhere she could go and he says he'll arrange it by the end of the day. Amanda arrives at the beach house just after Michael sends Kimberly off to Minnesota. Like, it's an amazing one leaves and one enters scene. Beautifully done, Michael. He wakes up the next morning on the couch and checks in on Amanda in his room. She says she feels worse, and he says they'll initiate the second half of the new chemo later that day. Just then, an insurance company representative arrives unannounced with a settlement, and he's ready to write a check as soon as he talks to Kimberly. So Michael asks Amanda to pretend to be her and say nothing, because the story is that Kimberly is, you know, non-functioning after the accident, which the insurance company should be able to figure out is a lie because she does have a job at a hospital. but since Amanda's confused and feels like shit, the insurance dude falls for it. Billy visits Allison in her office to give her a nice day planner and to take some work off her hands. She gives him some clients to summarize and says that she needs it done by the end of the day, so he'll have to work late. He returns that evening with everything she asked for, and she kisses him and starts to unbutton his shirt. They reminisce about meeting a whole 3 years ago. And then bone on the desk. Amanda and Michael come back to the beach house after the chemo treatment, and Michael explains that he loves her and he will do whatever it takes to help her survive. She asks him to stop saying he loves her, even though there are mutual feelings there. That was brave of Amanda to admit that. The next morning, Allison's all business, but Billy wants to talk about feelings and their relationship.
This was one of my favorite exchanges. Like, I love how the tables... Oh, how the tables have turned.
Yeah. So apparently Billy's the new Jane now. Like, with his feelings journal. She says that she'll head to whatever event is that night alone because he'll have to work late again on more summaries. And he says that she's stupid for pushing him away when she needs all the help she can get. Billy brings Amanda's agency separation forms to the beach house. She's come to the realization that she's always defined herself by her work and never realized that her life always had value just because she was alive. Matt finds Michael in the hospital hallway with some forms to check and notices that he's distracted. Michael explains that he's not used to being in love and that he loves Amanda more than he's ever loved anybody or anything. Matt reminds him that he's married, and Michael mentions that he's waiting for a payoff so he can drop her like she deserves. And then she could come and kill you, but that's another story. Michael arrives at the beach house and calls out to Amanda, who he finds passed out on the kitchen floor. He carries her out to the car, and as they leave out the front door, Kimberly enters through the slider on the deck. Again, another beautiful one-in, one-out situation. She finds Amanda's stuff in their room, including a prescription bottle with her name on it, confirming her suspicions. Jake gets a call at Shooters from an old friend named Sam, who tells him some bad news, which he won't share with Sydney. Joe finds him later in the courtyard at Melrose Place, and he tells her that his mom died, and he's not sure he wants to know how it happened, but we know it was drinking. She'd been living in Ellensburg, Washington, with Jake's half-brother, and Joe offers to travel with him there for the funeral. Sydney walks up in time to catch them hugging, and Jake explains the phone call earlier was about his mom, and Sydney offers to come along too. But thankfully, Jake has a way to make her stay, which is that he needs her to watch over everything at Shooters. Just wanted to inject a little personal note. I've been to Ellensburg, Washington, and my husband went to college there. And the location where they filmed looks nothing like Ellensburg, Washington, because Eastern Washington is very flat and very dry, kind of quite the deserty place. But you know, they did a good job capturing a place that's at least a little quaint like it. So decent job. Go ahead.
No, never mind. Okay. Go ahead.
Joe and Jake arrive in Ellensburg and meet with Sam at his law office. We learn that his mom died after an argument with Jake's brother, Jess, and he's beside himself, and the gas station he owns isn't doing well. And that guy, Sam, is played by Noah Emmerich, who a lot of people would know from The Americans.
The Americans. Yeah, I like saw his face and I was like, oh my God. And also, like, he's beefier in this show.
Yeah, yeah, he's a lot bigger here than in anything else I've seen him in, which is really unusual. Like, you know, mostly people can't really change their size in a permanent way, so.
Right, yeah. I was very caught off guard by that.
Yeah. And if you haven't watched The Americans, I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, God. Joe and Jake find Jess at his garage, and they offer to help with the arrangements, but Jess is just mad that their mom ended up back in Ellensburg after wanting to move L.A., and then Jake wouldn't have her.
And so I saw this guy and I was like, I know that face. Like, who is that? I know that face. And I looked it up and it was freaking Dan Cortez.
Yep.
Cortez?
I think it's Cortez.
Who was like everywhere in the 90s.
Yeah. He's an MTV sweetheart for sure. He's done a lot more acting than I thought he had.
Yeah, he had way more credits on his Wikipedia and like even some more recent. So, I mean, he definitely seems to have like, he just kind of probably went into TV acting, you know, popping up in, as like one-off characters in different shows and stuff like that.
But he was also on Veronica's Closet, which lasted quite a while.
And Caroline in the City, which we've talked about before on this show.
The funny thing was, I'm glad I looked him up because I almost came on this podcast and said that he had his own starring role in a movie called If Looks Could Kill, which was about somebody trying to take over the world financially, taking advantage of the European, Euro unification. But that was not Dan Cortez, that was Richard Grieco.
The other guy that was everywhere in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, the two of them could be fraternal twins, let's face it. Sam runs up to the funeral where everybody's waiting for Jess and lets them know that Jess is probably not coming. So finally they start the funeral after Sam freaks out for a moment about all the stuff that needs to get done.
Like right there at the funeral.
Yeah, like, shush.
Yeah, Joe was like, not now. Like, bro.
Jake and Joe head to Jess's trailer where Jake finds Jess mad because he can't find their mom's jewelry box. He's convinced Jake took it, but is drunk and exhausted. So they sit on the couch to talk it out. Jess is mad that he spent his whole life so far stuck with their mom, which is funny to me because he's supposed to be like 25. So, like the fact that you're now free, you got your whole life ahead of you, dude. Like 25 is nothing. Jake leaves with Jess telling him to go to hell on the way out. Joe brings beer, chips, and dip back to the motel, and Jake opens up about his anger with his mom and brother. He feels bad that he never returned to take care of things with her, and then he angrily throws his beer against the wall, but thankfully this time it's a can. And then he makes passionate, angry love to Joe sideways on the bed. The next morning, Joe heads to Jess's garage alone to talk to him because she meddles. She says Jake loves him and it's killing him that they're fighting. He's still mad that he was only 2 years older than Jake, but basically had to raise him. And eventually, he and Jake broke into a store and they got caught and he took the fall so that Jake wouldn't get into trouble. He went to juvie and Jake got to be a football star and then he ran away to LA. So yeah, that does kind of suck. But in the car, Jake apologizes to Joe for the sex the night before and says that it was great, but they both awkwardly agree that they aren't ready for a commitment. Which makes no sense to me. Like, they find Sam and Jess at the trailer, and Sam explains that he can sell it and get them a little money. Jake says it should all go to Jess, who then says that he doesn't need the charity. Jake fires off a few lines about actually caring for Jess, and then Jess apologizes and says maybe they can talk sometime. Aw. And that's the end of that episode.
That turned so quickly.
Yeah.
At the end. It was so, it was fine. It's fine. It's not the stupidest thing that's ever happened on the show. But for him to be like full of like decades of anger and resentment and rage at Jake. And then at the end to just be like, maybe I'll call you sometime.
Yeah. Oh,
sorry.
I don't know why he's not thinking about coming out to LA, you know, or maybe he is. Actually,
yeah, totally.
I can tell he definitely is. Maybe he'll
pop back up. Yeah, he's going to pop back up, I'm sure.
Yeah, I got to say, his look was really something. He looked like a 90s cartoon to me. Like, he had the hair, he had the sculpted facial hair. It was everything.
Oh, yeah, that goatee. Oh, my God. Yeah. That goatee was, like, peak 90s.
He looked like he would actually be dating Matt, to be honest.
I could see it, yeah. Maybe he'll come to L.A. and start dating Matt.
That'd be great. Wow, these episodes went fast.
Yeah, they went really fast. I mean, there's just not a lot of commentary to make on some of the stuff that happened other than just, like I said, I'm still not totally buying into Amanda and Michael. It's kind of ew. I will say this, like watching these episodes, I was thinking about how, you know, like, all I've ever heard is that Amanda Woodward was like this huge bitch on this show and kind of backstabby. And that's not the impression that I get of her most of the time. Like, she seems like a very assertive person and kind of a bitch, but just, like, not very duplicitous, which is something that I thought, I always got the impression from the way people talked about her that she was probably constantly scheming against people. And it's not, yeah. She doesn't do shit behind people's back. She does it to their face, you know? Yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I was just thinking about that watching these three episodes, how she seems very forthright. And that was not what I thought she was going to be like going into the show.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, people do love to mischaracterize a strong woman, right? Like,
yes. very true. What else is there to talk about? That gate, the cop situation, it... like resolved itself so neatly. Well, again, like this show loves to create just this huge mess and then just it all gets wrapped up in this one scene.
Yeah. Yeah, thank goodness Trigger Happy Joe was on the case, right?
What else happened? Jake continues to be everybody's hero and just be the general all around good guy. I like him and Joe together so much.
I know. They should redo that. Make their own baby. No, don't make a baby.
But I'm kind of not mad about them being like, hey, we can just be friends who hook up occasionally.
Yeah, they should do that. But, you know, it takes like a lot of anger to like push them over the edge. So I think it's going to be when something bad happens, they'll bone it out.
Oh, yeah. Like, sex is their comfort language or something?
Yeah. Like, it's how they heal.
Understandable.
I mean, we can all relate, right?
I mean, who?
Who among us?
Yeah. cool. Well, I guess that's the episode. I don't have anything else. What else happened? Sydney continues to be Sydney. Jane and Jake was stupid.
Do you think I don't think they boned before they broke it off, did they? Probably not.
No, I don't think so. I think Jane's definitely a wait kind of girl, you know, like.
Unless it's like super inappropriate, like with her lawyer right. Who's handling her divorce. come on, Jane, just pretend it's like really wrong for you to do it and you'll do it.
Exactly. So yeah, I don't think they had sex. No. I think we would have seen it if they did.
Oh, well.
So, yeah. That's the three episodes.
Ooh. All right. Well, thanks for joining us again. You can find all things Melrose Sheltering in Place on Instagram at Melrose Sheltering in Place.
There you go. And I guess that's the end. So we're going to now say goodbye. Goodbye.
Bye.